Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We did a program on New Year's Eve with someone from Popular Science Magazine, and they were informing us of the leading science stories of 2012 and what we can anticipate the leading stories will be of 2013. And one of the 2013 stories is what we're going to be talking about this hour. It's the Non-Human Rights Project. It is the only group fighting for the actual legal rights for members of species other than our own. The way our current law categorizes animals, according to this organization, is wrong, and it's time for that to change. It was founded in 2007 by our guest this hour, Stephen Wise, and it is made up of many, many people, including Dr. Jane Goodall. They've come together for one purpose, to break through the legal wall that separates humans from non-humans, thereby gaining legal personhood for non-human animals. They're going to begin with some of the most intelligent animals on Earth, like chimpanzees, elephants, and dolphins. These are complex animals who have deep emotions, understand each other's minds, live in complicated societies, transmit culture, use sophisticated communication, solve difficult problems, and even mourn the loss of their loved ones, just like humans. But they are considered property. They are considered things, not humans. So how does this work its way through what courts? And what do you think about this? Stephen Wise is our guest, president of the Non-Human Rights Project. He has a law degree from Boston University and teaches animal rights jurisprudence at several law schools, is the author of a number of books. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Stephen. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Stephen. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, a great pleasure. Before we talk about the law, let's talk about some of these animals, because I love these stories, and I've been reading about elephants who can speak Korean, the Korean language, and what happens with elephants. Please tell me about some of the complex animals that have communication systems that you are in awe of, the animals that seem to be human in many ways.
Well, the ones that we are focusing in on are ones that I personally began to focus in on almost 20 years ago, and ended up focusing in on them in the first two books I wrote. And the first one was Rattling the Cage Toward Legal Rights for Animals, and the second one was Drawing the Line, Science and the Case for Animal Rights. And in there, I focused on bonobos, which are also called pygmy chimpanzees, the common chimpanzees, African Indian elephants, a cetacean as a whale, an orca, a dolphin, African gray parrots, and the reason I focused in on these species of animals is because, number one, there's really quite a lot known about them. There are a lot of scientists who've chosen to spend substantial parts of their life studying them, usually in the wild, but also in captivity. And that there's been a lot that we've learned about them, and what we have learned about them showed that they have an extraordinarily, as you mentioned, extraordinarily complex cognition. They are not only are they conscious, many of them are self-conscious, that they understand that that there's an I in their mind, and not an EYE, but an I, capital
mm-hmm.
I. They have complex communication systems, and I forbear from calling it language only because I don't want to get into the argument as to how you define language, because people don't agree on that, but they certainly are able to communicate in very complex ways that appears to involve some kind of a grammar. They have learned human-like languages. In Iowa, Sue Savage Rumbaugh has been working with bonobos and chimpanzees now for 30 years, and she has taught Kanzi, is the most famous student. Kanzi has learned, you know, hundreds and hundreds of complex lexicons, abstract ones, can probably understand 3,000 to 5,000 English words.
Oh my goodness, really?
You can watch Sue kind of carry on a conversation with Kenzie, and Kenzie clearly understands what is going on. Then there are other chimpanzees. There was Washo, who clearly understood some variant of American Sign Language, as does Coco the gorilla and Shantek the orangutan at the Atlanta Zoo. There are Lewis Herman out at the University of Hawaii worked with two Atlantic bottlenose dolphins named Aki and Phoenix for years and taught one of them a whistle communication system and the other one a manual one. And they clearly had some kind of a grammar. In that they, if you say, put the toy on top of the tube, they'll understand that is different than put the tube on top of the toy. So they understand what's going on. Some of them appear to have elements of a theory of mind, in that they not only are conscious and they understand that they have a mind, but that others have a mind too, and they can take the mental perspective of those others and imagine what they are seeing or hearing. So the more that we learn about them, both in captivity and in the wild, the more impressed we are by how complex they are, and that of course then leads to the question as to whether or not they should simply be our slaves, so they should be considered things and property, or whether they should be legal persons who are really containers for some kinds of their own rights.
And what has happened to their lives by our classification of them as things rather than as humans?
Well, when you are a thing, you are seen as existing for the purpose of persons. So you don't have any legal status yourself. You are seen as existing for someone who does have legal personhood. You don't have any rights at all. You're just a thing that other people can own and do whatever they want with, including killing you. And we've seen with the long, sorry history of human things that it's a very bad thing to be a thing, and the only way that you can avoid being exploited in that way is to become a legal person, which essentially means you're a container for legal rights that can range from the very large, the fundamental, the right not to be killed, to the more insignificant.
Mm-hmm. And the stories of some what's happened to some of these animals just makes you cringe. The story, I guess I wasn't as aware as I should have been about what's happened to a number of elephants who are being used for I don't know, circuses and performances, etc., who just live these terribly constrained lives and get sick very early and die very early. And when they are able to have their lives changed, they absolutely flourish, don't they?
Indeed, they do. There are elephant sanctuaries in which elephants who have managed to be pried away from circuses or other places in which they're required to do, you know, very un-elephant things, and are oftentimes trained in ways that are very painful and involve them being beaten. Mm. They indeed do flourish. They are. I have a chapter on elephant intelligence in Drawing the Line, which is now, I wrote in 2002, so it's 11 years old, and there's been an increasing amount of data coming down that shows that they are even more complex than I thought they were in 2002. They are extraordinarily complex beings who are not only abused when they are in captivity, but are being slaughtered increasingly in Africa for their ivory because of the enormous appetite for ivory in China and Japan.
Mm-hmm. So legally, you're going to be doing some big things this year, is my understanding. Are you?
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
All right. What are you doing?
What we are doing is these are going to be the first suits in which anyone has actually claimed that a non-human animal is a legal person. In other words, has the capacity for having a legal right, and indeed has some kind of a legal right. So the suits are going to be brought, and we're probably going to be filing two. The suits are going to be brought by the animals themselves, They are likely to be. We have not finally chosen the jurisdiction which state we're going to choose, and so until we do that, we can't focus exactly in on which non-human animal is going to be the plaintiff. But we've narrowed it down to. We keep narrowing it down to a smaller and smaller number, and we're going to make our final decisions in March and file a lawsuit in the last quarter of 2013. And we're going to be claiming that our non-human animal plaintiff is a legal person and has certain fundamental rights under the common law. So we're going to be filing in a state court. We're not going to be filing in a federal court. And we're not going to be filing under a statute or a constitution, but we're going to be saying that under the common law, which is really the law that judges make in our state courts, that these non-human animals should be legal persons with certain kinds of fundamental rights. And as I said, it's going to be the first time that anyone has ever done that. I personally have been getting ready for this for 25 years. I started in more than that, 1985, began researching a series of law review articles, and then began teaching about this at Vermont Law School and Harvard Law School and Lewis and Clark in Miami and St. Thomas and other law schools, and began turning out a series of books. And then in 2007, actually brought the Non-Human Rights Project together. And now there's about 70 volunteers working all over the United States to get these suits ready. And they include who you might think they might include, lawyers and law students and law professors. But they also include people who are expert in media relations, psychologists, sociologists, mathematicians. Mm. There's a wide variety of people, all of whom are focused on the attempt to, or these first suits in which we are going to try to get legal personhood for our non-human animals.
This is absolutely fascinating. Now, will you pick one species, or will you include elephants, dolphins, the ones that we know are highly sophisticated animals? There may be others down the road, but will you pick just one of those species?
We will actually pick one individual.
One animal?
Yes. It'll be Jomo the elephant against whoever is holding Jomo the elephant or beating Jomo the elephant or whatever. It'll be a single elephant or a single ape or a single orca who's being held in an aquarium or something like that, and it will be that specific non-human animal against the defendant who is either, you know, violating her bodily integrity, you know, hitting her, beating her, and or keeping her in captivity. And if it's an animal who's a wild animal, we will be seeking an order from the judge ordering her out of captivity and back into the wild or into a rehabilitation pen, say, a sea pen for an orca, in which she would be rehabilitated to go back to her family. And we're likely to have several causes of action, but one of the major causes of action will be a common law writ of habeas corpus. The common law writ that's been around for about 700 years that human slaves used both in the United States and in England, that villeins used in England to try to encourage courts to recognize that they were free and that they were legal persons with certain kinds of fundamental rights. And we are going to be doing the exact same thing. In fact, in preparation for this, in 2005, I published a book called Though the Heavens May Fall, which recounted how the human slave, James Somerset, in England in 1772, used the common law writ of habeas corpus in order to gain his freedom and really begin the process of ending human slavery in England and eventually around the world. And the reason I wrote that book was as a blueprint for how any being who is improperly being viewed as a legal thing can persuade the court using a common law writ of habeas corpus to declare that she is a legal person with the fundamental right to liberty.
Mm. Well, as you were talking, I could just see this, what is now a thing, receiving this worldwide attention. I mean, this is quite a spectacular thing you're doing here. So you will bring attention to what kind of intelligence, what kind of empathy this elephant or whoever it may be has, and the world will have to take notice of this. Maybe they haven't taken notice. Is that the case?
But they are. That's why I just had a 2.5 meeting with Jane Goodall, who's on my board
of
directors.
Oh, did you? Uh-huh.
And, you know, Jane is four square behind us, and as will others. The famous documentary filmmaker named D.A. Pennybaker, who just won an Oscar last month for Lifetime Achievement, the first documentary filmmaker to win an Oscar for Lifetime Achievement, saw that we were interesting almost 2 years ago and has been filming us around the country wherever we meet for the last 2 years. And we'll be in the courtroom when we try the case. We'll be in the courtroom when we argue the appeals. And so there will be a D.A. Pennybaker and Chris Hegedus, his wife and fellow filmmaker, documentary about what we have been doing sometime whenever we're finished our first cases.
Hmm. Well, do you have to, without being too corny about all of this, and I'm not sure how it would be accomplished because you'd want the elephant to be in a place that was good for the elephant, but would you have to do something as dramatic because we live in an age where people go to YouTube to see the remarkable things that everybody does, including animals? Would you have to have the elephant who speaks Korean testify in some way, or the elephant to look at his or her image in a mirror and show that he knows that he's there, he recognizes himself? Do you have to do that kind of thing?
Well, yes, we will be prepared to present the testimony and the affidavits of the foremost scientists who study these animals their entire lives. We are working and will be working with a broad spectrum of scientists from all over the world who will be prepared to file affidavits about it, and will also be prepared, if we can have a trial, to actually come in and testify about the cognitive abilities of the animals that they studied for so many decades, both in captivity and in the wild.
But what about the animal that you choose? Will that animal testify in some way?
Well, that is a really good question. It's never been done before. There are pros and cons to it, and frankly, we're not finished arguing about that yet.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Oh, what an interesting thing is happening here. Stephen Wise, president of the Non-Human Rights Project, and you're going to hear from them in a large way in the year 2013. We're going to welcome phone calls and emails and Facebook messages in just one moment. Our number here is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. He is president of the Non-Human Rights Project. He has practiced animal protection law for a number of years and is author of several books, including Rattling the Cage Toward Legal Rights for Animals, Drawing the Line, Science and the Case for Animal Rights, and the list goes on. And we'll be with you momentarily. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this hour, a new history of the Amistad Rebellion told from the perspective of the 53 Africans who took control of their slave ship in 1839. It is a story that has certainly been told before. To great acclaim in a Steven Spielberg film. This book that we're going to focus on really looks at the whole history, the lives of the people who were on these ships, and how they happened to be captured, and then, of course, the rebellion and what happened when they came to the United States against their will. It's a fascinating story. The author of The Amistad Rebellion, An Atlantic Odyssey of Slavery and Freedom, is our guest. Let's go to phone calls. Stephen Wise is our guest right now. There is one line open. If you've been trying to get through, it became available. 800-486-8655 is our number. Betsy in River Falls is our first caller. Hi, Betsy.
Hi.
Hi.
Mr. Wise, I would like to know how I can financially help your Non-Human Rights Project. It's not that we say we're anthropomorphizing animals when we give them their qualities. We actually came after they did, so we've got their qualities. And yahoo for you. I haven't been this happy, and I can't remember when. So please let me know how I can help.
Well, anyone who wants to support us at all, we have a website. Look it up in Google, nonhumanrights.org, and we have a Facebook page, Non-Human Rights Project. And while I haven't looked at the donation button myself recently, I feel certain it's there. And or you can send me an email at wiseboston@aol.com.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. WiseBoston
at AOL.com.
AOL.com. Now, did you say, and I just didn't hear you, where you were going to be exposing, what court you're going to go to, what state you'll be in?
That, we have put in between 30 and 35,000 hours of work in the last 5 years, substantially, to try to figure out the answer to that question, because once we decided that we were going to file suit in the United States, and we weren't, and at the beginning we weren't sure. We looked at countries all over the world and focused in on the United States. And then we have 50 different state jurisdictions. So there's perhaps 40 or 50 or even 60 different legal issues that are all intertwined. So we have had to run those 40 or 50 or 60 relatively complicated questions through all 50 states to try to figure out where we might want to file our initial states, which jurisdictions might be the most favorable, or at least the least unfavorable to us. So it's been tens of thousands of hours with numerous meetings on this, and we are now coming toward the end of this, and I'm afraid I can't tell you right now which ones they are, but we've narrowed them down to five or six, and we will be making our final decisions in March, and then we are going to be part of a two-day conference with an organization called IEET out of Connecticut. They're putting a conference on at Yale, and they're going to on I think it's called Legal Personhood Beyond the Human, and the first day there will be philosophers talking about that at the end of April, and the second day is devoted to the Non-Human Rights Project's work, and at that time, we will announce the states in which we have decided to file our first suits.
Okay. Jeff in Flambeau, hi.
Hello. My question is in regards to the chimpanzees. Jane Goodall stated that chimpanzees actually battle each other in the wild, and they kill each other and eat each other. And a number of years ago, a domestic chimpanzee tore the face off of a woman. And I guess my question is, are we going to have capital punishment for these kind of crimes if we give them human rights? And what happens when two female chimpanzees communicate that they're lesbian and want to marry?
Well, I think the last one is not a serious question, but the other ones actually are serious questions. Well, first of all, in fact, I should have been writing them down as you were speaking, because they're all things that we actually have argued about for years. And I've actually spent some time in Uganda around wild chimpanzees, who I was very aware of when they were, 3 feet away from me, could rip my arms off. They're extraordinarily strong beings. Now, Jane has talked about them engaging in what she considered to be virtually a civil war. She was the first person to understand that they indeed did fight and sometimes even kill each other. They don't eat each other. Chimpanzees have never eaten each other, but I have seen them indeed hunt black and white colobus monkeys in the Kibale Mountains in Uganda. They do that, and they do eat them. The next thing is that chimpanzees would not be getting human rights. Only humans can get human rights. Chimpanzees would be getting rights that are appropriate for chimpanzees. And so just like an orca, a dolphin, an African gray parrot, an African elephant, they would not get human rights. They would get those kinds of rights that are appropriate for them. But the first thing that the Non-Human Rights Project is trying to do is to have our non-human animal plaintiffs be seen as rights containers, as legal persons, beings that have the capacity to have any kind of a legal right at all. And then we begin to argue as to, which of the infinite number of possible rights might they be entitled to have. And that will depend upon the individual plaintiffs. I think you had some other really good observations in there as well, and I'm afraid they just kind of went in one ear and out the other.
Yeah, that's okay. We have a lot of callers, and I want to do a follow-up on this, too. So when you pick, let's just say for the purposes of discussion, that it's going to be an elephant, and when you ask for rights that are appropriate for that elephant, will that be a part of the discussion here, that elephants, because they are no longer classified as a thing, can no longer be held in captivity, and zoos can no longer be trained to be in circuses, can no longer have certain kinds of force used against them. Is that the way this will go, or will it go another
way? That's the way this is going to go. We would first argue that an elephant can be a legal person, that is, have the capacity for a legal right, and then we start arguing as to which legal rights they might be entitled to. One of them might be the rights that are fundamental to them. So, for example, the right not to be in captivity, what I call the right to bodily liberty, the right not to be hit, you know, or struck or trained mm-hmm. in a brutal way, which is the right to bodily integrity. And we would ask a judge, using a common law writ of habeas corpus, to remove them from the situations in which they are being beaten, they are being held captive, and move them into sanctuaries.
All right. Thanks, Jeff, for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. An email from Brianna states, what about animals in zoos? I feel very sad to see them in small enclosures and wish that this could be changed.
Well, I feel very sad, too, and that's one of the things that we are looking at. We're beginning with those creatures that are relatively indisputably, you know, the most studied, the most complex, cognitively complex, and just trying to persuade courts that legal personhood is not something that humans should have. There's no reason why only humans should have them, that there are at least some non-human animals should have them as well. And once the court recognizes that indeed legal personhood is something appropriate for a non-human animal, then we begin to look at the animals one by one and the possible rights one by one. And those animals who a court recognizes as being legal persons, we then may begin to argue that they can't be held in captivity any longer.
Is it going to be hard to determine how many animals should have a different kind of classification? Are you studying that now? Does it go way beyond the ones that you have mentioned?
Well, Darwinian evolution would say that there's virtually, and you know, well, there are thousands and thousands of animals, and some of them are almost imperceptibly different from each other. And where you draw the line needs to be in some kind of a rational place, but it will require expert testimony and having courts who listen very carefully to and understand what the experts are telling them about what the cognitive abilities of these animals are.
Mm-hmm. G in Madison is next. Hi, G.
Hello. Yeah, I had a couple of questions for your guest. First of all, I'd like to say how much I appreciate what he's doing. It's been something which I've been interested in all my life. I come from India. I totally believe in ahimsa, and I used to be a doctor. But in 1991, I gave it up because I could not, compromise my principles and make my living off animal suffering like in labs. And, you know, and being a doctor who prescribed medicines and surgical techniques based upon animal research. So my first question would be to the guest, what does he feel about animals in medical labs who are used for, because people justify that, say, oh, it's for human health, etc., etc. That was my first question. My second question is that, when people talk about animal rights, they often bring up the fact that, you know, poor Africans hunt elephants and stuff like that. But I'd like to have an opinion about people who live in the West or rich people all over the world. They may believe in animal rights. They may be, even be vegans like I am. But the very fact that we have houses, TVs, cars, etc., we are automatically causing a lot of animal suffering that way. So I'd like his opinion about, you know, the interlinking of environmental concerns and animal rights. And my last question to him was, what kind of rights is he fighting for? For example, I completely understand that they cannot be human rights because they're humans and we are humans and they are non-humans. But would they get, for example, things like property rights? Because all animals, all biological creatures require a living space. So would they get things like property rights, which would make their habitat inviolable?
All right. Let's start with the third question. I find that very interesting.
I was going to start with the third, too.
Good.
There are many thousands of species of animals. And there are probably a million species. There are probably half of them are insects. But there are thousands and thousands of species of non-human animals. And then there's a wide range of cognitive abilities within species as well. And the beauty of the common law for the last 700 years is that it's very flexible, and judges make it, and it allows you to, or lawyers to bring, you know, case after case after case in which you struggle along with the judges to try to understand, say, which non-human animals should have rights, and who are these animals, what kind of cognitive abilities do they have, and what kind of rights should they have. It's very difficult for us to look, you know, too far down the road, because there are so many things that are going to happen once we attain the first step, which is having a common law court recognize that our non-human animal plaintiff is a legal person, you know, has the capacity for rights. After that, it's going to be a struggle for the legal rights to identify them of non-human animals, the way it's constantly been a struggle for hundreds of years to expand and refine on the various rights of us human beings.
Right. And what about labs? There are still chimpanzees being used in labs. Or what kinds of rights do you think are at play here?
Well, chimpanzees are such extraordinary beings. You know, I have spent time around chimpanzees, both in the wild and in captivity. I have probably spoken to all the important chimpanzee researchers all over the world. I visited them in Japan, in Africa, in throughout the United States, and you know, they are undoubtedly, absolutely, cognitively complex, extraordinary beings. They should not be used as our property. They should not be things. They need to come out of laboratories. They need to come out of zoos. They need to be left alone. They need to be able to live their own extraordinarily complex lives.
Hmm. Thanks, G, very much for your call. And let us go next to Heidi in West Salem. Hi, Heidi.
Hi. I kind of wanted to go back to a point that you were dealing with right away before you started taking calls about the, I guess, expanding on the types of animals. He sort of touched on that, but using the idea that there are so many complexities that we don't understand, you know, and I mentioned the example of, you know, dogs understanding sit, stay, roll over, those kinds of things. They understand human commands. And, you know, I don't think it takes too much to understand that animals understand types of communication, different types of animals, horses, everything like that. It's a natural thing. But I was wondering then also based on that if his organization would consider helping fetus unborn children achieve legal personhood, since they don't seem to have that, and then they wouldn't have to be victimized in utero.
Well, let me address that. In every state, in every single state, if not nearly every state, human fetuses are already seen as legal persons. They already do have a wide variety of rights. The right that they don't have, according to the United States Supreme Court, is they're not a legal person, not under the common law or within the meaning of state constitutions, but within the meaning of the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution. And so the problem with for fetuses is that because they are not legal persons, but the mothers are, the mothers' rights will trump the non-rights of the legal fetuses. And so that is a constitutional issue, and indeed one of the things that the Non-Human Rights Project does is we stay entirely away from constitutional issues. They're way, way too complex, and they also have to do with how federal courts interpret them, and what we're interested in is looking at state court judges and how they might interpret the common law. And indeed, we may argue that because under the common law or even under the state legislation, in the states in which we choose, fetuses are legal persons, that's another reason why a non-human animal such as a chimpanzee should also be a legal person.
Mm-hmm. You have a lot of the literature, and you write about this pretty extensively. You wrote about this in a book, but it was not all that long ago. We must remember that many human beings were treated as things, and this story of slavery, which resonates deeply, we'll be talking about it tomorrow again. It wasn't that long ago. Slaves were things. They were not human beings.
Absolutely true, and that is why in my book, Though the Heavens May Fall, I focused in on the 1772 London trial of James Somerset, who was a slave captured in Africa, like the folks in the Amistad, who were brought over to Virginia, and then he was enslaved for more than 20 years, and his master would bring him up and down the eastern seaboard and then finally brought him to London, where he escaped, was recaptured, and then there was a full-scale, highly publicized trial in London before Lord Mansfield, who was probably the finest judge ever to speak English, who was confronted with this problem of whether or not, under the common law, a human being could be a slave. And he finally ruled that that slavery was so odious, and he used the word odious, that the common law would not accept it. And he ordered James Somerset freed. And really, that's what my book is about. And our argument is that for at least some non-human animals, that the their slavery is so odious that the common law should not support it either.
Mm-hmm. John in Richland Center, hi.
Hello. I'm getting frustrated. Thank you for letting me talk. With human arrogance, to feel that we need to teach these animals or these beings human language to prove their intelligence. And, I mean, when you get something that's particularly like the orcas, who are extremely intelligent, have been around much longer than we, have no need for homes, financial support, any of the things that we rely upon, but yet they've been around and communicate with each other, and maybe we should try learning how to speak their language.
I'm sorry, what were you referring to? I didn't hear that.
Pardon?
What are you referring to? What animal?
Orcas.
Orcas.
Okay.
And, you know, one of the examples is sometimes they come off and they will beach themselves. Maybe that's in protest as to what we're doing to them and their environment. And I would like to hear your guest comments on your
yes.
study.
Thank you. Okay.
Towards that.
Thank you.
We are in communication with many orca specialists, and some orca specialists are working with us. And indeed, an orca or another cetacean, some kind of a whale or a dolphin, is a highly likely plaintiff in one of our first suits. And you don't need to teach an orca a human language in order to show how incredibly intelligent they are. There are many people who have studied them in the wild, and it's clear that orcas have an extraordinarily acute intelligence and should never be kept in captivity, never.
More phone calls in a moment. Our phone number for Stephen Wise, who is president of the Non-Human Rights Project, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And you can also tweet us your thoughts, and that's @KDunnShow. This show came about actually because we were talking with Popular Science magazine people on New Year's Eve about the big stories of 2012 and what we will look to as the big stories of 2013. And this story really caught our attention, that at some point in 2013, the Non-Human Rights Project will be entering a courtroom with a specific animal, will be a plaintiff. It may be an elephant, it may be a dolphin, it may be one of the other animals we know to have pretty sophisticated intelligence. And the project will be working toward actual legal rights for members of species other than our own, to have them classified not as things anymore, but as people, and then the process of what kinds of grants should they be granted because they are no longer things. It's really interesting. So we'll take more phone calls momentarily. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Stephen Wise. He's president of the Non-Human Rights Project. He is a person who has written extensively. He teaches animal rights jurisprudence at several law schools and is the author of 4 books on this issue. And we're welcoming calls for him. Let's go next to Barbara. Hi, Barbara.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead.
Well, first of all, I don't have any kind of degrees. I have been very, very interested in animals. I went on a so to speak, safari in Texas, a tent safari. I enjoy animals. My friend and I found out that because we're so much into animals that we knew more than some of the people who had actually come there from Africa. I want to know what I can do, not just monetarily. Is there something that I can do to volunteer? That's number one. And number two, we always say orangutan and bonobo. I hear you say orangutan and bonobo. Could you correct me and also answer my question how I can volunteer?
All right, Barbara, thanks.
I have no idea. Bonobo, bonobo, orangutan, orangutan, whatever. I think as long as we all know what we're talking about, that's probably sufficient. You can send an email to us at the Non-Human Rights Project. You know, go on either Facebook or our website, and someone will get back to you and find out what you might be able to do. There may be something, but there may not be something, because our organization is really kind of chock-a-block with lawyers and scientists and sociologists and mathematicians and who are trying to do specific things in order to win lawsuits. So I'm not really sure, but you never can tell. And we would certainly be quite pleased to have you contact us, and we'll see if there's anything you can do. We are really a virtual organization. We are a 21st century organization in that our 70 volunteers are all over the United States, and you know, from Seattle down to Miami and Boston to Los Angeles. And so we communicate primarily by a conference call and Skype, and then we meet at regular intervals as well in subgroups. So we shall see.
You may want to keep this a surprise, but I'm wondering at this point in time if you are auditioning, for lack of a better word, any animals to be your test case.
We are not, but we're reaching that point. Usually a lawyer gets a client and then decides what jurisdiction he or she's going to sue in. We're looking for our jurisdiction first, and then we're going to find our client within that jurisdiction.
I see.
We are within 2 months of, after many years of hard work, we're within eight weeks, really, of deciding what our jurisdiction is. We already have an idea, and we do indeed have our scientific working group beginning to look at the possible plaintiffs in the jurisdictions that we are slowly narrowing down.
Nick in Algonquin, hi.
Yes, good morning. A fascinating conversation. We are curious to know, my wife and I, that is, if you have delved into the area of cryptozoology, those species at all. I'm specifically, of course, referring to the Sasquatch phenomenon and research that's now being conducted, gaining validity as time goes on. And I know of at least one state, I believe it's California, that has also passed legislation protecting these species if discovered.
No, we haven't. We are aware of non-human animals that we can point to right now who are being held captive or being abused whose bodily liberty or bodily integrity are being violated, and we will be using those animals that we can look at and bring into court as a plaintiff.
Thank you, Nick, very much for your call. Linda in Hales Corners, hi.
Hi. Earlier in the program, Kathleen said that you, Mr. Wise, have practiced animal protection law for a number of years. And my question, or what I would like to ask you to discuss, is the distinction in animal law between animal rights, which is what you are doing, and that's really legal trailblazing, and animal protection, such as protection of animals under the Animal Welfare Act and the Endangered Species Act. And the reason I ask that question is because quite frequently animal rights is used as an argument by industries and people who use animals against animal protection measures.
Well, that's a good question. Animal rights do not exist. And when I teach my class in animal rights jurisprudence, I tell my students, you know, at the beginning that we're not talking about a system of law that exists. We're talking about a system of law that we are trying to have come into existence. So the work I do for more than 30 years now as an animal protection lawyer is to protect the interests of non-human animals whenever I can. For example, you know, one small example, though it's not that small, in Massachusetts, where I'm licensed to practice law, I've represented probably 150 dogs who have been ordered executed and over the last 30 years, in which I go in and try to stop their execution. Or I might get involved in a veterinary malpractice case, or I might get involved in a case under the Endangered Species Act. The non-human animals themselves don't have rights and are not the plaintiffs. And that's one of the problems that animal protection lawyers have, is that you have to somehow protect the interests of non-human animals indirectly, because they themselves are, because they are not legal persons, are essentially invisible to the law. And you have to find indirect ways of protecting them, and that simply does not work. And I realized that within the first 5 years or so of becoming an animal protection lawyer. And so for the last, you know, 25 years or so, I have worked to try to lay the foundation for the first cases that would seek true animal rights, to have the non-human animal plaintiff be a rights bearer, a legal person with real fundamental rights herself. And that's what we're not, you know, we're ready to go in 2013.
I guess
it's
you
happening.
Are. Do you, Stephen, have animals either that you live with or you visit regularly who you would consider your friends?
Well, I have had some companion animals in my life, and I haven't had one for a long time. And my wife just got a little dog 2 months ago over my protest.
Really?
Yes, we are not because of animal rights issues, but because we travel so much. I teach not only in the United States. I teach in Barcelona. I lecture all over the world, and I wasn't sure whether it'd be fair to that little dog that we'd be gone so long. But we got the dog from a foster home, and the foster home loves him, and so they have very graciously assented to keeping him with the other dogs that they have when we're gone. And when they open the door, he just bounds in, and he seems to forget us until we come and pick him up. So I'm very happy about that. And he's lucky, because I work out of my home, and my wife works out of the home too. So he really has this 24/7 if we're not traveling.
Linda, thanks very much for your call. And Stella in Sturgeon Bay, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to raise a quote from a very wise person from our state, Gaylord Nelson. He
yes.
said that the quote is, the economy is a wholly owned subsidiary of the environment. Usually this quote is applied to extractive situations such as mining or lumbering or real estate development, but it seems to me it is equally applicable to our non-human fellow residents of this planet, and in particular to their property rights, which were raised by a previous caller in regards to their property rights to be able to be to have sufficient environment to be able to live. So that may be a quote possibly you can use.
Actually, you brought up something interesting. 46 states have passed some variant of the Uniform Probate Code or the Uniform Trust Code that over the last 10 years that allows people to set up trusts for an animal. The intent of it was oftentimes when someone passed away, your companion animal would be a beneficiary of a trust, and you can get a trustee and enforce to the trustee. But the animal herself has a beneficial ownership of the proceeds of that trust. So, to some degree, we've seen the very first crack in the door of a non-human animal actually being able to own property. They do. They have equitable interests in the corpus of the trust for which they are beneficiaries.
Stella, thank you very much for the call. Well, this goes down as the most interesting show that we've done this year. It's early, but I think it may be way up there. Please stay in touch. We'll stay in touch with you. It's absolutely fascinating what you're doing, and what a big year this is for you.
Yes, I would be delighted to stay in touch with you, and thank you for such an intelligent hour.
Yeah, thanks to you. It was so interesting. Stephen Wise, who is president of the Non-Human Rights Project. I would recommend all of you who have called with wanting more information, we'll put a little note on our Facebook page, but just Google Non-Human Rights Project, and you'll find out about the fascinating, and indeed it is, fascinating work they're doing. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning, who produces this program. Thanks for all of your calls. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 9, and great conversations are ahead, so please stay tuned.